And now to our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
E.J., let's start with the jobs numbers that we just heard about, a drop to 8.6% in unemployment. A solid indicator for President Obama, or is it more a case of, you know, been down so long, it looks like up to me?
Maybe a little of both, but it's just so good after months and months and months of sitting here on some Fridays and talking about awful jobs reports to have one that is pretty good. Floyd Norris, writing in The New York Times this afternoon, made a point that the unemployment rate is falling among workers with lower levels of education. That's good news. The number of long-term unemployed workers is starting to fall. That's really good news, too. That's the part of the country that most needs relief. But as your piece pointed out, there are a lot of discouraged workers, which adds to sort of gave an artificial look of improvement. Still, this is a whole lot better than anything we've been talking about for a while.
And David, when we think about these numbers, we've been talking a lot about the economy and obviously the presidential campaign to come. The Obama campaign has been talking a lot about the demographics that it feels it can stitch together successfully in 2012. How do you see this playing into that campaign?
Well, I think they've more or less quite rightly given up on the white working class. Ohio, Pennsylvania, those are going to be tough. They have to try to get the suburban voters. And I'm still a little down on this job market, this job report. Losing 315,000 people from the labor force, people don't vote on the headline number. They vote on their lived experience. And if the 55-year-old guy next door is not even looking for work, that's bad. And so I still think it's kind of negative. I think the good news today is I did a lot of reporting on what's happening in Europe, and I thought a European collapse would really sink the Obama presidency and all incumbents. And today there's pretty good news on that. I think there's more confidence than before that they're heading towards some sort of settlement in Europe. There's less likely to be a euro crash. And so the good news is from Europe. I think the job report's a little negative.
Let's move on, if we can, and talk about the ever-surprising Republican presidential campaign. With the ascendancy that we've been talking about for a few weeks now of Newt Gingrich, does this have staying power, David Brooks? Where is Newt Gingrich headed, and how long will he be a player?
Yeah, of all the flaky non-Romneys, he's the best. He's the most impressive. Romney is really weak among these high school-educated voters, and he's showing a little brittleness. He gave an interview this week to Brett Baer of Fox News where he was really unattractive. He used one sentence that drove me up a wall. Baer accused him of being a flip-flopper, which is not exactly novel. And Romney said, well, we should be a little bit more informed about my policies, using the royal we. Like, we should be eating our broccoli, Brett. And it was condescending. And if he doesn't do any media and then he finally does one and comes off kind of unattractive, that's a problem. And Gingrich, I still think he'll implode. He's still Newt Gingrich. One moment doesn't lead to the next with Gingrich. It's one thing after another. But he's strong. Romney, moreover, weaker than he's looked in months.
It wasn't so long, EJ, that the Gingrich campaign was written off. His campaign staff had, as we said, imploded and disappeared, taking the high road.
Well, we're going to have a weird campaign if we have one candidate who uses the royal we and Newt Gingrich, who always seems to refer to himself in the third person as Newt Gingrich and often as a world historical figure. This is a very weird campaign. I think conservatives desperately wanted Rick Perry to be the guy. And then Rick Perry imploded, and everything has followed from that implosion. And now, of course, we have Herman Cain supporters loose, I think, or what looks like Herman Cain supporters will be loose. And I think the significance of that is that they will probably, for the time being, go to Gingrich. Can Gingrich be disciplined between now and January 3rd, the date of the Iowa caucuses? That is the question in the Republican primary.
You mentioned Herman Cain. And again, a candidacy that it just seems to be stranger by the minute. David Brooks, what do you make of the week with Herman Cain?
You're a guy who's had several sexual assault or charges made against you. You run
harassment
for president, harassment, and you think that's not going to come out? It's a level of self-deception that is bizarre. You should have some self-awareness of what's going to come out if you run for president. And he apparently didn't think this through or thought he was running for talk radio host. You know, I think we've seen him crater if you look at the polls dropping quite fast.
And a very public sort of self-examination of when he's going to be making this announcement and whether he will or will not stay in the race, EJ?
I think he's got a fascinating new approach to scandal management, which is, I deny that's true. There's no truth to it. Now, what are those charges again? I mean, you had one day where he was saying, no, this is wrong, and his lawyer was saying, well, these charges shouldn't be part of the public discourse. They're personal, and they were consensual. So it was a consensual consensual non-affair. I mean, it's remarkable. I guess I was never one who took this candidacy seriously for having long-term staying power. But I think Kane is obviously himself fascinated by all the attention he's gotten, and he just can't stand getting out of the limelight, even though that's what he's going to do. Although, as always, he'll probably end up on Fox News or somewhere with a wide following.
A moment also to bring up the name John Huntsman, which we haven't talked about for a little while, and in particular, a song. I've been looking forward to listening to this with you guys all day.
Hey, hey, Mitt, what are you going to say?
I believe that abortion should be safe and legal.
Tell us, Newt, what's your game?
Mickey Mouse games.
Rick Perry, what's your stance?
I stepped in it, man.
Dr. Paula Michelle.
Okay, so those are three of John Huntsman's daughters with a song apparently not authorized by the campaign, who is saying that they have gone rogue. It's their version of the Justin Timberlake song Sexy Back. They're calling it Huntsman's Back. David Brooks, wishful thinking on their part. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm a 19th century guy. Unless you're as cool as Justin Timberlake, don't do Justin Timberlake. That's why the Mormon Tabernacle Choir does not do Kanye West. And so I like dignity in daughters, and so I never like these moments.
EJ?
First of all, this is the first time we've given something close to a minute to John Huntsman, so good for the daughters.
They probably we'd rather be talking about something else.
And second, the Republican base is going to react exactly as that 19th century figure David Brooks just did.
Not bringing in the younger demographic, you don't think. No. All right. Thanks, you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times.
Enforcing fiscal discipline is a key function of credit rating agencies. They're supposed to give an objective assessment of risk and a borrower's ability to repay loans. But the current world economic crisis has raised hard questions about the assessments made by the big three rating firms, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. And charges that they've not only missed the onset of financial crises, but helped fuel them with faulty judgments. Robin Farzad is senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
And please remind us what these credit rating agencies do and why they have such influence.
Long and short of it is they tell you, the investor, the investing community, whether an entity is good or not for its money. That could be a government, that could be a company. But the problem is that the investment management community, the financial services industry, by and large, subcontracts that due diligence to the big three rating agencies.
And how do they miss stuff as big as the collapse of WorldCom or Enron or MF Global just a few weeks ago?
You know, every time they tell you, we rolled up our sleeves and we gave it a good, honest try. But they've had critics time and again that have said that's not the case, because how many times can you get it wrong? If it wasn't subprime and the great financial crisis of 08, then it was Enron, it was WorldCom, it was the telecom stock bubble. Before that, it was the bankruptcy of Orange County. New York very nearly went bankrupt in the mid-70s. They got that wrong. And to their credit, they've come back every time when Congress has dragged them forward and said that, you know what, this is our constitutional protected editorial opinion. We were not, in fact, making a buy or sell judgment. We were just telling you what we think. So caveat emptor.
Well, and so what should small emptors do, like small investors?
That's why this is so problematic, because small investors, even small mutual fund companies or big mutual fund companies, do not have the ability, look at the case of the subprime mortgage crisis, to go in and actually take apart a security that might have tens of thousands of individual mortgages in them, do spot checks and make sure that these people didn't lie on their loans. You largely have to take it all on good faith. Everything, when you step back from this, Washington every time swears that it's going to be the last time that we get kind of bamboozled by the ratings agencies. But the reform is vexingly difficult. You have Al Franken.
Explain that to us, because there have been so many proposals, obviously.
There are lots of platitudes thrown at this idea of we need more competition. We need upstarts, the honest, hungry, smaller qualitative firms that are willing to do this shoe leather research to come out and fight this triopoly of the ratings agencies. The problem with that is that you have governments and financial institutions that are restricted in their charters from only being able to buy investment-grade securities. And there's a circularity. Who can rate these investment-grade securities? Well, it has to be the big three. And so there is this idea, people are coming to terms with it, that it is increasingly going to be business as usual with the big three ratings agencies, and they live to see another boom and bust.
Hmm. So in the case of a situation like Greece in the Eurozone crisis, the ratings agencies failed to predict the apparent or imminent financial collapse of Greece, and yet Greece will not be able to proclaim that they've made a recovery until they satisfy the financial agencies that they have.
Yes, and this has since moved on from Greece. We're talking about Portugal, Italy, Spain, countries, economies that in real time are seeing their borrowing costs spike in no small part due to what the ratings agencies say. I mean, these securities get bought and sold on the basis of a stamp that's given to them by the big three ratings agencies, and that's largely been unhindered.
Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, speaking from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
There's a new book for children about a bear who's lost his hat. The book is called I Want My Hat Back. It's by John Klassen. Daniel Pinkwater joins us. He's our ambassador to the world of children's literature. He joins us from his home in upstate New York. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Scott, it's always my great, great pleasure. And I wish to make a statement to no particular purpose.
Sure.
Over the years, I have looked at, Scott, thousands of picture books.
Right.
I have written and illustrated dozens of picture books. Mm-hmm. Plus, I have worked on books with some of the finest illustrators. And I want to share with you what I have concluded about picture books with all this experience.
Yes.
They got to have pictures. The book we're going to do is a book that relies heavily on art. Listeners can't see it. We have to do our best to convey it.
Well, let's begin to read and describe the pictures.
I understand I am to give voice to the bear.
You are always the bear, I've noticed. I play the rest of the forest, but you are always the bear.
Well, there's reasons for that. It's, for one thing, I can wear a bear suit without any padding. This is a great bear. He's standing there. He's looking as dumber than any real bear could be, and he says, my hat is gone. I want it back. Meets a fox. Have you seen my hat?
No, I haven't seen your hat.
Okay. Thank you anyway. Moves on. Now it's a frog. Have you seen my hat?
No. I have not seen any hats around here.
Okay. Thank you anyway. Now, he runs into a rabbit who strangely is wearing a little pointy red hat himself, and he says, have you seen my hat?
No. Why are you asking me? I haven't seen it. I haven't seen any hats anywhere. I wouldn't steal a hat. Don't ask me any more questions.
Okay. Thank you anyway. Here's a turtle. Have you seen my hat?
I haven't seen anything all day. I have been trying to climb this rock.
Would you like me to lift you on top of it?
Yes. Please. Next page, the bear encounters a snake. I identify with snakes. I don't know why. Maybe it's all the prominent S's. And, of course, the snake, as is their wont, is upside down, hanging from a tree limb.
Which you often do.
Just after lunch.
Have you seen my hat?
I saw a hat once. It was blue and round.
My hat doesn't look like that. Thank you anyway.
The suspense is really building, yeah?
I don't know what this animal is. What do you think? I was thinking maybe an armadillo.
It could be an armadillo.
Maybe a muskrat. Anyway, the bear talks to this animal.
A muskrat would have more fur. I think it might be an armadillo. Although, what would an armadillo be doing in a forest?
He could be just, visiting. Yes. Have you seen my hat?
What is a hat?
Thank you anyway. Now the bear's lying on his back in the weeds. He's thoroughly depressed. Nobody has seen my hat. What if I never see it again? My poor hat. I miss it so much.
All right. There's an elk standing over the bear.
Or a deer or a moose. I don't know.
A great rack, in any case, which is what they say in the forest.
It's an ungulate, and that's okay to say, too.
All right. And the elk opens the conversation. What's the matter?
I have lost my hat, and nobody has seen it.
What does your hat look like?
It is red and pointy, and the bear sits up. I have seen my hat.
And suddenly...
Now he's running. He runs past the turtle. He runs past the fox. He runs past the snake. He runs past the armadillo or whatever it is that we are not sure. Confronts the bunny. You stole my hat. Double page spread. The rabbit looks at the bear. The bear looks at the rabbit. Now the bear is sitting. He's wearing the hat. I love my hat. Here's a squirrel.
Excuse me. Have you seen a rabbit wearing a hat?
No. Why are you asking me? I haven't seen him. I haven't seen any rabbits anywhere. I would not eat a rabbit. Don't ask me any more questions.
Okay. Thank you anyway. Last page.
Nothing.
The bear is sitting there, just a look of quiet postprandial satisfaction, I think it's safe
well,
to say. Yeah.
It's fantastic art, and it's minimal text.
Mm-hmm.
And as a bear author artist myself, I have to tell you I'm a little jealous of this bear. Now, bears, they loom large in children's books.
Well,
Goldilocks, no end of successors.
Yeah, no. Winnie the Pooh.
You know. Bears may stand for adults in some way because they're big, they're ungainly, they're goofy, they like most of us grown-ups. But the bear in this book, paws down. He's got to be the dimmest, most slow-witted, brilliantly stupid bear to come along in years. I really love him.
The book we read, I Want My Hat Back, is by John Klassen. Daniel Pinkwater, the voice of the bear, is the author of many fine books for children and for adults. His latest is Bushman Lives. As a matter of fact, he's serializing it ahead of publication for free. What a deal. On pinkwater.com. Daniel, thanks for speaking with us.
Scott, a joy and a pleasure. Look out for bears.
I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear the day I read a book.
Jimmy Durante again. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
I know because it had no plot, it wasn't a mystery. Because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again.
Tomorrow marks the 10th anniversary of a technology that hit the market with high expectations. In hindsight, impossibly high.
What Henry Ford did in the last century for rural America is what this device will do in the next century for city dwellers.
That's inventor Dean Kamen, whose secret invention had two code names, Ginger and It. People in the know used words like revolutionary. Steve Jobs predicted it would be bigger than the PC. But the public had no idea what It was until December 3rd, 2001, when Kamen unveiled it on Good Morning America.
We're talking about the Segway. The self-balancing scooter weighed roughly 100 pounds, could go just over 12 miles an hour, with a price tag starting at $5,000. Now, while many tech experts were wowed, not everyone was impressed with Dean Kamen's invention or his hyperbole.
I believe the Segway HT will do for walking what the calculator did for pad and pencil.
Adding, or what the beer hat did for both beer and hats.
That's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show shortly after the Segway's unveiling. Well, 10 years later, walking has certainly not gone the way of the pad and pencil. And since its splashy debut, the Segway has made few headlines, except when President George W. Bush toppled off one.
But the device hasn't been a failure either. About 100,000 have rolled off the assembly line in the last decade, and the company turned a modest profit early last year. More than enough to require a calculator.
Is Siri anti-abortion? She is the voice-activated tool that comes on Apple's newest iPhone. And earlier this week, abortion rights groups raised a fuss when Siri sent people seeking abortions to anti-abortion sites. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Let's get one thing straight. On its face, Siri can seem, well, a little sexist. Siri, where can I get birth control?
I don't see any birth control clinics. Sorry about that.
Obviously, there are plenty of places to get birth control here in Washington, D.C. Then I asked her for Viagra.
I found 16 drugstores. 12 of them are fairly close to you.
But what outraged abortion rights advocates was that in many large cities, particularly New York and Washington, when you asked Siri where you could get an abortion, she would respond with something like this.
I found 2 abortion clinics a little ways from you.
By little ways, Siri actually means 27 and 74 miles, respectively. And neither of those are actually abortion clinics. Both are crisis pregnancy centers. They're places that not only don't do abortions, but actively try to talk women out of having them. Both cities, by the way, have multiple abortion clinics. Jody Jacobson is editor of RH Reality Check, a prominent abortion rights website.
Initially, people thought that the programmers had deliberately left something out. There was conjecture by many colleagues that perhaps because they were afraid of the anti-choice community.
But it turns out the actual reason is far more mundane.
It is, at the end of the day, just a dumb tool.
Damon Potter is a reporter with PC Magazine. He says there's 2 things going on. One is that Siri doesn't use Google, by far the most sophisticated of the search engines.
Google has had a decade to refine its results and get smarter and smarter about what people actually want when they do searches. Siri is in its infancy.
The other is that crisis pregnancy centers do search engine optimization. They use the word abortion a lot because they want to attract women in search of abortion. That's not the case with actual abortion clinics, says Jody Jacobson.
And the ways in which we might be self-censoring, then lead us to have search engines that don't fully inform us about what we need.
Apple says it's working to fix the problem. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Celebrity auctions have become pretty common, but once in a while, they're still a real event. The entire collection of Elizabeth Taylor's jewelry, clothing, and memorabilia is on view starting today at Christie's Auction House in New York. There will be a 4-day auction starting December 13. Some 2,000 objects from the film star's life will be on the block, both at Christie's and online. NPR's Marco Adler has more.
Well, it's a very special collection.
I'm standing in front of a glass wall, looking into an area that has been decked out as if it was Elizabeth Taylor's walk-in closet. At least 80 handbags out of more than 200 are arranged by color, one shelf violet going to purple, another reds, another browns. Shoes and boots on the floor, drawers open with jewelry dripping out of them. Meredith Ethering Smith has curated the fashion part of this exhibit. Of Taylor, she says,
gutsy, glamorous, wished I'd met her.
And why this faux closet?
Because that was what her house looked like. She kept everything immaculately.
Then clothes from every designer you can think of in perfect condition. A red velvet Valentino ball gown, a Dior organza jacket in white with delicate handmade flowers, but also wild colors. In one corner, what Etherington Smith calls a cast of caftans, some in historic fabrics.
A lot of them were made by Thea Porter, who used to go around the Middle East finding fabrics and then reassembling them as caftans. The 3 heavily embroidered groups are antique Ottoman. So that was when Miss Taylor was going through a sort of modified hippie phase.
But most extraordinary, the jewelry. Diamonds, sapphires, rubies, many of them gifts from the 2 of her 7 husbands she loved best. Actor Richard Burton, who she married twice, and theater and film producer Mike Todd. Daphne Lingen, a senior vice president in the jewelry department of Christie's, is standing with me before a case filled with emeralds. Almost all of them gifts from Richard Burton.
The emerald and diamond pendant brooch that hangs from the necklace, that was an engagement present in 1962 from Richard Burton. And it was also worn when she married him in 1964 in Montreal on her yellow chiffon dress.
The one that's over there, the yellow chiffon dress that we're looking at right over there.
Exactly. And then the emerald and diamond necklace from which it's suspended, that was the wedding gift in 1964.
There's also the 33-carat diamond ring, conservatively estimated estimated to go for between $2.5 and $3.5 million. And perhaps most amazing, the 16th century La Peregrina, one of the most perfect, largest pear-shaped pearls in the world, found in paintings by Velázquez, once part of the crown jewels of Spain. Rahul Kadakia is head of the jewelry department at Christie's. He says since the late 1700s, Christie's has sold the greatest collections of jewels, Doris Duke, Princess Margaret, the Queen of Italy, on and on.
And they are all great collections, but never have we seen a collection that's as complete and as curated as this one.
The finest Burmese rubies, the finest diamonds, the finest Colombian emeralds. And what does he mean by saying she was a great curator?
It was not just the jewel, it was the design, it was the person who made the jewelry. You think of every great jewelry house in the world, she had something from all of them.
While the official estimates are that the auction will bring in around $50 million, everything has been priced as if Elizabeth Taylor never owned it. So privately, people say the $3.5 million diamond ring could go for $7 million and so on. It's all on view for the next 10 days, more opulent than the tree at Rockefeller Center, 100 yards away. As Etherington Smith put it,
it's like going to a museum, really, isn't it? You know, you just have to kind of take a step back.
All proceeds from the four-day auction will go to Taylor's estate, with a portion going to her AIDS Foundation. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.